I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We're celebrating 24 years in business and just entering our 11th year of doing open line programs. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have a new 2018 open line format that comes with the launching of our new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication event tab. Our second book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icon on our homepage. Plus, later in 2018, or next 60 days or so, we're going to have our third book out, which is Cracking the Team Building Code, and it will be available. And we also now offer skills testing, which is on top of doing our in-depth work style personality assessments. It doesn't take the place of it, but I would say that it's definitely it has a really great start, and people are enjoying using our skills testing program. So if you're interested, just let us know. Our topic today is fumbling strategic acquisitions, the do's and don'ts. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items. We're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the very first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, team building, stress management workshops, and much more. We have an office in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas of how to interact with a U.S.-based company, just let us know. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to the calls we get and responses from clients, and that's how we come up with the various topics from our clients that are both domestic and global. So this one is this topic is perfect for today, I think, as we're going to enter in probably, according to the vicious economists, a business slowdown later this year and a mild recession going to next year, as Rob and I were just talking about. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area. You can send questions or ideas during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of the program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. So during our time, you can either send them in through the chat box or write two or three questions down, and you can ask them later on. Our special guest today is Robert Scherer, who's a good friend and business buddy. He's the founding partner of CEO to CEO, a consulting firm of former chief executives that improves the leadership infrastructure of mid-sized companies seeking to accelerate their performance. He was chief executive of Bentley Publishing Group from 1984 to 2006 and steered the firm to become a leading player in its industry, which was decorative art publishing. Rob speaks frequently and has published extensively on the successful leadership traits and skills of leaders in mid-sized companies. He's a regular columnist on Forbes.com, has numerous posts on Harvard Business Review online, Entrepreneur.com, and CFO.com. He's authored two books. The first book, The Feel of the Deal, How I Build a Company Through Acquisitions, and his newest book, Mighty Mid-Sized Companies, How Leaders Overcome Seven Silent Growth Killers. I've read both, and I highly recommend reading both books. He also publishes his own newsletter, The CEO Insomnia Factor, which is phenomenal. Rob received a BS degree in business administration from Hayward State University. During that time, he was actually running a small business and has an MBA degree from St. Mary's College, where he was the recipient of the Jack Salama Award for Student Citizenship, and he taught MBA and executive MBA courses at St. Mary's on growth entrepreneurial businesses. I feel privileged to have Rob with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. At the conclusion of our program, you'll see a registration for our next program, which is called Dealing with Multi-Generations. Rob, welcome back to Open Line, and thank you for talking or sharing ideas on this topic.
Oh, delighted to be here, and this is a topic I really love. So So thank you for having me, Dana. And we're going to talk a lot about acquisitions. Boy, it's a great way to grow your business. But at the risk of sounding anti-acquisition, it's not a strategy. It's not where we start. And so let me explain that. And I did four of these acquisitions in growing Bentley Publishing Group. But acquisitions are a tactic to drive strategy. And so let's look at what are some of those kinds of strategies. Well, customer intimacy. Hey, we're going to understand our customers and connect with them in an amazing way. Or maybe we're going to have the newest, smartest products. It's product innovation. Or we're going to be the low-cost leader because we're going to be so efficient that we're going to win on price, right? We're going to have a one-stop shop, have all the products our clients might need. That's one that we've really moved heavily on in Bentley Publishing Group. Or maybe we're going to differentiate by specializing in one particular area, right? So those are strategies. And acquisitions aren't a strategy. Being bigger, we're going to buy a business so we can be bigger. That's not a strategy. Bigger is not. It's a tactic. And so one of the biggest risks that we see, one of the biggest pitfalls, is buying a company because they're for sale or because we feel like we can or it just feels good, but not sitting back and saying, why is this the unique solution, the unique way to execute on one of our strategies that makes us a better, stronger company along those lines? So really, really important concept that I want everyone to think about. If you look at your own strategy and the vision for your organization, and it's all unclear, don't buy a company because you'll just get somewhere faster, but it may not be what you really want. So when I look at all, there's a lot of different tactics to drive the strategies. Let's say you are clear on that. Well, maybe you're going to be a new product machine. Maybe you're going to sell more effectively. You know, how well we sell and our technique at selling, that can be an important tactic as well. There's back to efficiency. Maybe we're going to change our business model. There's a lot of interesting things going on there, including pricing model. Or we're going to expand geographically, or we're going to raise our prices, right? Premium product, premium price, push the price up. Maybe we're going to outsource some of the things that we do inside of our business because they're not really core. They don't make us special. And then last, acquire companies. These are all different tactics. And if we're going to put $500K or $1 million or $10 million into acquiring a company, the question is, could we become a better, faster, stronger company instead by just expanding geographically and opening up a warehouse or tuning one of our processes? So this is really important. And I just sat with a client and we went through exactly that. They'd made an acquisition. It was going okay. But when I really challenged them to say, why is acquisitions the right way to grow? And for what you spent on that acquisition, if you had spent it instead in another way, could you have not grown more? And it really got a very powerful discussion going to identify certain acquisitions that would be additive, right, that would add more than just the scale. So big, important concept. I'm not against acquisitions. They're fun. They can be a great tactic to grow, but it's just one of those particular tactics that you might use. So, you know, background, right? So we started off, I founded with a few others a company called Bentley House, and we published art. So pretty pictures, posters, if you will, that we sold to picture framers. And it started out with a very American style. You might call it sticky sweet. But it was that kind of a look. Worked really well. And then we said, you know what, we want to grow, but we didn't seem to have the ability to pick different styles of art. And we noticed that our growth was slowing down because there's only so much of a certain look, that look that we had that people really wanted. And so we bought Reinhardt Fine Arts. That was our first acquisition. Much more contemporary art. And we were surprised after we made that acquisition. That sells? You're kidding. That? You look at the numbers, though, holy Toledo, it was selling. We learned a lot that way. And then Leslie Levy Fine Art had more Southwestern looks. And then Aaron Ashley was sort of traditional American, very old brand. That's really the subject of The Feel of the Deal, my first book. And then, you know, the last one, Rom Fine Art, had photography. But in some senses, that was the least strategically motivated of any of them. It was like a nice bolt-on. And funny thing, that was one of our biggest headaches. It didn't drive strategy. it was the smallest, but one of the biggest headaches. And so, again, every deal can be great, but often they are not great. And so, you know, little bit of background on what I actually went through there. So, you know, what really makes them risky and difficult? Well, it's that they're complicated. And, you know, we did some surveying, and we did a survey of mid-sized companies. This is a couple years back now, but the numbers don't really change. And we asked them, hey, how many of the acquisitions actually raised revenues, right? We added the two companies together, revenues were higher. Well, two-thirds said it raised revenues. Now, that might seem obvious to you, but there's plenty of times when a company's purchased and they lose customers, right? It doesn't. You know, 1 + 1 does not equal 2. 29% said the revenues kind of stayed the same or decreased. So that's, you know, not too scary. But the next statistic is that only 45% said the combined profits increased, right? So those synergies, quote-unquote synergies about, you know, saving cost and driving revenues up, that didn't happen most of the time. 49% say they stayed the same or decreased. So the odds, just flat out, the odds of doing acquisitions and having them work wonderfully are against you because it's such a complex move, a complex tactic to make.
Hey, and Rob, question came in. When you did the acquisitions, what are the top three things that you learned that the should do's and the don'ts?
Boy, the top three things. You know, I may want to come back to that at the end.
Okay.
I think
okay.
One learning is that knowing how to do them and having the right advice is super powerful. On the first two or three, I had a mentor that I would call out to, and here's what just happened. Am I crazy or are they crazy, right? So the knowledge base is really, really important. I think another thing that I really appreciated was I was buying companies that were very similar to my own. So I knew a lot about how to operate them, and I was very thankful for that because there's enough surprises as it is. So those are two that would jump out, but I think we'll see some more lessons that came out partly from my own experience, but partly from about 50, 55 interviews to support Mighty Midsize Companies, the second book. Fair enough?
Thank you. Okay. Perfect.
All right. So there's one thing that I think is a starting point that we really have to think about, and some companies decide to buy a company. It's a project. I want to buy that company. They have something I really need. And that's okay, but that's very different than a program of growing through multiple acquisitions. And so there's a couple of points that I want to address on that. One is that if it's really just a project, you can rent expertise, right? You can find a consultant. You can find an investment banker or a lawyer who know a lot about the project and how to do it. And that may make a lot of sense. But if you realize that growing through acquisitions is something that will be an ongoing operation, you really want to think about building competencies internally. And that is one of the biggest risk reductions, is that in an acquisition, they come the growth and the step-up of complexity and revenues come so quickly that if you try to learn it all as you go, you'll make some pretty big and fundamental mistakes. And so we then start to think about, well, if we're going to do a series of acquisitions in a year, does anyone on our team have that expertise? Should we hire someone? I've got a client right now I'm thinking of. They're in the process of hiring a COO. And they've just done one acquisition that went fairly well. They may want to do quite a few more. So it's a high priority that COO have acquisitions experience because they want to bring that in-house. And we'll talk more about that later, but that's really important. When you have a program, there's other things that are really important as well. So money, right, a war chest, just the money to make those acquisitions. And, yes, there are many times when you can get seller financing, and there's ways to finance deals, but it still costs a lot of money. It's not just what you pay. It's internal costs. You often have to invest in those acquisitions. So, hey, how much money should we pile up? And maybe we shouldn't spend capital on other growth initiatives if we're going to want to reserve it for acquisitions so we can fund every acquisition properly. The third thing to think about is reputation. So when you do one acquisition, if that seller doesn't think that highly of you, you made some mistakes, there were some problems, you know, that's not the end of the world. But if you're going to start to, what we call it, roll up an industry and make two, three, four, or five acquisitions, your reputation as an acquirer is incredibly important. When you have a great reputation, you get deals with less competition. People come to you first, which means there's less bidding. So understanding that and thinking about that is really, really crucial. I think the other thing that's the difference between a project and a program is everything that happens after a deal closes. And most books out there talk about getting a deal done. And most M&A professionals are really excited about getting a deal done. But to them, done means the paper signed and the check is passed. But for those of us that buy businesses, that's not nearly done. That's the beginning, because we have to integrate the businesses and understand them and get the accounting cleaned up. Maybe we're merging plants. Maybe we're merging people. There's all kinds of work that has to happen after the deal signed. And understanding how to plan that is crucial. You certainly want to plan it even if you do one deal, but one deal can be a step up in complexity. But when you do multiples, you have to understand how to plan ahead of time, how to execute it, how to get it done, because one deal layers on top of another deal. And one way to make a really unstable company is make too many acquisitions, not really integrate them well, don't have a good foundation, and then wonder why nobody's making any money and why we can't get things done. So this project versus program thing, really important.
That's a really good point, because one of our clients has been acquired, and the acquiring company, I think they're up to, they boast that they do around 10 a year. And there's just a lot, all the things you're bringing up are then multiplied. And the bottom line's
right.
The bottom line. But
yes,
they feel good about it. But is
right.
It,
and so, you know, boy, if you're going to do 10 a year, and we've got a great case study in Mighty Midsize Companies, where you'll build a whole team just to acquire and integrate. And in that story, it's in the porta potty business. But, you know, they had one or two people that analyzed deals. And then as soon as they buy a small, usually regional company, they had a team they would fly in. And it was three or four people, and they'd be there for 30 to 60 days. And there were systems and processes around how they standardized various things. But they built ongoing capacity to be able to integrate at that level. And they had a very clear strategy about who they'd buy and when. And so, yeah, great point, Dana. When you look at it that way, it becomes an operation just like accounting or anything else. And done well, you can really make it run efficiently. Done poorly, it's dangerous. And there's plenty of roll-ups, especially when they're driven by just financial buyers that don't understand business operations. They just think you just buy, stick them together, and you're good to go. Those often crash and burn. And I will add, if you're a seller on the line and you get someone doing a roll-up and they want to buy your business and pay you in equity, be careful, because too often that equity isn't worth anything when you're all said and done. So we're going to kind of move on now to the searching, right? How do you find the company? We've gotten our perspective around how we're going to do this. Is it going to be a process? It's lined up with our strategy. And the truth of it is you can't look at every company that might be for sale. You just don't have enough time. And so we have to think through the creation of a screen, sort of an outline of the kinds of businesses we're looking at. And you see some on the screen there. Hey, what size range makes sense? Is a $100,000 revenue business per year, you know, good? No, it's too small. It doesn't even move the needle. All that legal work and headache and risk for a tiny business. But on the other hand, a $50 million business, do we have the money to buy that? Do we even have the leadership and management to know how to integrate a company of that size? And it's relative size. So in the book, we talk about this, but 50% of your size, if that's the acquisition, half your size, whew, that's risky. Not saying you can't do it, but you better be really good at it. But if it's 10% of your size, you know, that's a great starter acquisition. So there's one. Valuation ties into how much money you have and how much you're willing to risk. Region is having it in the next region advantageous, maybe because of logistics. or do you really need footprint on the other side of the country? Of course, on the other side of the country, it's a five-hour flight. It takes all day to get there, and you have to go there sometimes. So region is important. Headcount is critical. Performance level. Maybe you're a great turnaround outfit, and you can buy a business that's in trouble, turn it around fast, and make a bunch of money. Awesome. But maybe that's not what you want. You want a great company because it's their technology you need. You're going to want them to hum like they were humming before, but with their technology, wow, you can take it to the next level. And you know, competencies, do they have ingenious engineers? Is that what we need? You know, what's in there? So we create this outline of the kinds of businesses we're looking for, and then the first thing we do as we start to reach out is we say, do they fit? If no, put them back down and walk away. If yes, we keep going in the process. They call it screening. Okay? So really important. And, of course, it takes some work and discussion to figure out what's right here. What should we really be looking for? So now we're going to go on and talk about evaluating the risk of each deal. And all deals are not equally risky. They just aren't. And if you can mitigate some of these risk factors and the tie-in to your strategies and your vision is wonderful, it may make sense to take a little bit higher risk. But so many times companies get excited about buying some firm and they don't consider whether or not they're able to really bring it all the way home. Because if you can't buy a company and get the integration right and hit your numbers, right, there should be numbers up front about what ROI you're going to get on that acquisition, then don't do it. And through our research, man, if people who'd done series of acquisitions had just skipped their worst deal, their really stinky one, their ROI on average would have been so much higher. And so this isn't so much a challenge of getting the perfect company to acquire, but it's avoiding the worst ones because they suck so much time and energy out of the company. And in fact, in mighty mid-sized companies, we look for the seven most lethal growth killers to mid-sized companies, and a bad deal, fumbling an acquisition, made it in the top seven. That's how toxic it can be. Again, I'm not against them, but we have to do them with our eyes wide open. And so one of the tools, it's free, is on that link that you see on the screen there, mightytools.html, right? ceotoceo.biz/mightytools.html. It's going to take you through what we're going to walk through orally, but it asks these questions of you. You can go through, especially with a deal in mind, and answer the questions, and it will tell you how risky a given acquisition is. Really important tool. Don't use it once. Use it every time you're seriously looking at a company, and it'll really help you think through the process. So,
and we're going to be sending out the slides and audio in a couple of days, so if you want to write that down or copy it right now, you can have that. That's very nice of Rob to offer that, and then we'll be sending the slides also in case you don't have time to write it down right now.
Perfect. Perfect. So, you know, risk number one, and it's number one for a reason, is the M&A skills and experience that you have inside your company. So imagine if I walked into your door and interviewed each one of your senior leaders and said, hey, do you have experience at deal making, negotiating price, terms, right? There's a lot of elements around the price of a deal. What's the experience at that level? And yes, you can bring in a lot with a good investment banker. You can rent some of that. But there's crucial decisions that you're going to have to make. Do you have experience there? What about integration, seaming companies together? I remember back a couple of years, this wasn't a client, but it was a close connection of mine, merged two $800 million companies. Can you imagine the amount of work? And it was manufacturing, so production lines, dealing with redundant products, IT systems alone, holy cow, managing the market. They were both public, right? You know, it was a multi-year process with a lot of risk. Integrating the people, wow, so two VPs are the same thing and two companies emerging. How do you tackle that? So do you have someone on board with experience going through that and dealing with that? It's not different every time. It's, what am I going to say? There's many commonalities around the process of integration that someone with good experience can help you get through much faster. What about experience in merging teams and cultures? Wow, a lot of complexity there. Changing people and how they feel and think. Super slow, super tedious, doesn't always work. And then lastly, experience in the other company's industry. Because if we're buying a company that's in a different industry and they have a reputation and they have connections, lack of experience in running their business in their industry can create tremendous blind spots. Now, I'm not saying you can mitigate every one of these, but looking at these very carefully and saying, do I have enough skills and experience? And if I'm strong there, maybe I can afford taking other risks. But if I'm not, boy, go in light. Start to develop that well on your own. And this doesn't have to be the CEO. It could be the CFO. Bigger mid-sized firms have a corporate development department, right, where some of those experiences reside on an ongoing basis. So that's risk number one. Risk number two, cultural differences. I remember interviewing the leader of an accounting firm as part of the research, and boy, we spent the entire interview talking about how when they would come together that the first thing was cultural differences. So an accounting firm, the units of production are people, right, the partners and the relationships. And there's many businesses where relationships are really, really crucial. And so they would sit down and bring the partners together multiple times to get to know one another. They would work through scenarios to say, well, how would you handle this kind of a situation, whether it was an employee or a client? There's a lot of different ways to attack cultural differences. There's even surveys and that sort of thing. The more people there are, the more work that has to be done here. But two different cultures coming together is trouble. And yes, maybe one shifts to another, but more than likely there's a risk of having two silos and having the them versus us for years and never getting the synergy of having two teams really come together in that fashion. So risk number two. Risk number three is size, relative size. Size is important. And it's relative size in that it's the percentage one to another. So for me, a sweet spot is maybe 10 to 25% is big enough to make a difference, but not so big that it could overwhelm the parent organization. And I will say over and over again, a good starter is at 10% and maybe somewhat similar to the business that you have with a few additional add-ons or bolt-ons. That's ideal. Companies that go up to 50%, high risk, and a merger of equals where it's essentially two equal companies, incredibly complex. So be careful on size. The more people, the more customers, the more complexity, all those things come with size, make things very, very challenging. So rolling on to risk number four is just how much integration you plan. So realize there's this whole range between buying a company and doing nothing, just letting it sit there. There was, it's in the book, the local garden conglomerate, a very large public, for many years would buy a company and not even touch it. They'd come out and visit once a year. A little bit of financial reporting, that was it. You can do that. On the other end is where you say, no, we're going to take global operations of both companies, and we're going to merge leadership teams, we're going to merge facilities, everything all the way down the line. That adds a lot of risk. And so you can see on your slide there's a couple of levels in between. The more you integrate, the harder it's going to be and the trickier. What I'll also say is doing a little bit of integration early and then assuming you're going to do all the rest of it in a year or two, that can also be very high risk. When you acquire a company, the teams assume that there's going to be disruption in the first 3-4 months. They're kind of ready for it. But once you let normalcy settle back in and then you try to make major changes, the amount of work around change management goes up dramatically. So you want to think this through. I'm not for no integration. I believe that if you buy a company, you have to manage it at some level. Almost everyone will merge administration, accounting, back end. That often makes a lot of sense. And I'd say in most cases, that's a minimum. when you start to think about facilities and teams, it depends on how much like you they are. In my acquisitions, I was buying other publishers. We merged everything because they had posters, we had posters. Yes, the art was a little bit different, but by and large, tons of efficiency was gained by packing up trucks and moving it all together. We understood how to produce the product, how to print it. The only thing we normally brought on board was the owner's ability to select artwork. We had to learn that, and bringing them aboard in a kind of a contractor role made sense. So this is a crucial decision to think through. There is no one right pat answer. So 4 of the 12 done. 5th, earnouts. What the heck is an earnout? Well, there's plenty of times when you want to buy a company and they want $10 million and you think it's worth $8 million. Well, how do you bridge that gap? Well, you end up saying, look, seller, you know, I know you think it's worth $10 million, and if we grow the way you say we're going to grow, and if your products are so great, and we'll give you a commission or additional percentage that if it all goes the way you say it, well, you'll get $10 million. That's a $2 million earnout, meaning the acquired business has to earn its way through some of the compensation back to the seller. Earnouts are dangerous. They're out of fashion now. A couple of different reasons. One is that it's one of the most commonly litigated elements in an M&A deal because the person who doesn't get their earnout because things don't go the way they said it would want to blame it on the buyer. And it might be the buyer's fault. Maybe the buyer decides to invest less money into the infrastructure of the acquired company because something else was needed. So there's a lot of different ways that earnouts can go south. And when an earnout goes south, there's not only litigation, but the seller starts to talk ill about the buyer. It ruins the reputational aspect of the deal. And it creates other complications. I know one of the people I researched in the book had done, well, one did an earnout, and the seller was still to some degree in control of the business and started to jimmy the books and jimmy the numbers to get their earnout. That was an ethical challenge. In another case, the person was scheduled to get an earnout based on sales, but they weren't really disciplined about doing their sales anymore, maybe because they got a bunch of money for their business, yet that person was embedded in the broader sales team, and so they either had to get tough on the seller, which would hurt their reputation, or ignore the poor effort on sales, which kind of hurt team discipline. So you see there's all these challenges around earnouts. Now, if you do have to do one, make it the simplest number possible. Earnouts based on profit, oh, really dangerous. You know, the company, the new owner decides to go to Hawaii. You know, what is a real expense and what's right and what's not? Rife for debate. But if it was a percentage of revenues, for example, or a percentage of revenue sold to these 5 key companies that we wanted to break into and were promised, the simpler it is, the better it is, and the cleaner it is. On to number 6. The operating team's involvement. So very small and mid-sized businesses, the people who are looking at the deal are the people who are going to run the deal, right? They're the operations folks and the finance folks. But as you get bigger and mid-sized, picture a $100, $200, $500 million company that's looking at a $50 million deal, say, they may have a corporate development department. These are 3, 4, or 5 people who all they do is M&A. And one of the risks is that you don't involve the leaders who are actually going to have to run the acquired business or work with the acquired business. You don't involve them, maybe because you don't want them to know because these deals can be very secret, maybe because they're too busy, or maybe just out of hubris. But if they're not involved and all of a sudden they get the email, hey, we just bought this company, you need to go run those operations, wow. Usually there's too many surprises. They don't have buy-in, and in fact, it really does take operations people to know where the bodies are buried, where to look, to know what's possible. They contribute hugely, and so we want to involve the operating team early in the process. You know, maybe it's not the first day or the first month, but as we start to think about what should we pay, how much will we have to invest in this acquired business to get them up and running again, those are questions that the operating team should be highly involved in even before the papers are signed. Now, the downside is, of course, a lot of deals never get signed. So you might take some of your smart people in operations, distract them for a month, they're looking at this deal, they're weighing in on it, and then the whole thing blows up and they've wasted that time. That's a real risk. But you know what? It's a much lower price to pay than the CEO or the corp dev people buying a company, throwing it over the fence, and then having operations say, what? You did what? You assumed we could do what? Sorry, man, we can't. Okay. So operating teams involvement, really, really important.
Well, that's a really good point.
It is. And, you know, for the work that you do, Dana, right? Gee, should you assess, you know, the people that are coming on board? Now, you can't do that maybe right at the beginning of the process, but, you know, understanding due diligence and what's over there, that human side, super important.
Exactly. Yep.
So number seven is due diligence. So what's due diligence? The way these deals come together, you start to talk with a seller. They disclose a little bit of information, but you kind of have to trust them. And then you say, well, gosh, based on the information, if it's true, we'll pay $10 million and we'll structure it in this fashion. And you kind of agree at an upfront agreement about what it might be worth. But then all buyers get a chance to do their homework, to do some due diligence, to maybe talk to employees, look at data, get reports, information, look at contracts. These are all things that are all called due diligence because it's up to the buyer to avoid surprises. Yeah, the seller can't lie. That's true. They'll get sued for fraud if they lie by the buyer. But they also don't have to, like, be completely honest and just volunteer all of their warts and problems and risks. They don't have to. You have to find them out. And so if we're too much in a rush to get a deal done or we don't know how to do due diligence, we end up skipping some things or making assumptions about some things. What was it? There was a deal with Rolls-Royce, I'm trying to remember, but they forgot to put in the rights to the intellectual property, the name Rolls-Royce or something like that. It was a huge oops in terms of due diligence. And too often we want to trust the seller, we like the seller, we're excited about the deal, and it doesn't take too many surprises because of murky due diligence to drive cost up and results down. And so what are the main categories of due diligence? Financial, of course. There's legal due diligence. There's cultural due diligence. If there's software and code involved, for example, there's going to be IT due diligence. I've probably missed a few of them, but, you know, most good investment bankers, we even have our own list to say, hey, here's all the different things, long list that you want to check off to make sure we've looked here, looked there. What about environmental risk? Somebody been dumping drums of toxic waste out in the back. You buy the business, you know, bingo, there you go. So due diligence, really important. You don't have long to do it. Typically it's 30 days. So you have to rush in. There are ways of outsourcing some due diligence. You can hire accounting firms to help you. You can hire law firms that will go in and do the legal due diligence. And again, depending on the size of the acquisition and the real risks, it all depends. But due diligence, incredibly important. At the end of due diligence, right, before you ink the final deal, you say, well, I know you wanted $10 million, but $1 million of your receivables, probably not collectible. They're 2 years old already. Hey, we're going to pay $9 million now. And you know what? There could be a contingency to say, hey, if it turns out that past due gets paid, wonderful, we'll give it to you, but we're not giving it to you up front. So there's things that come out of the due diligence that adjust the price, that shift the risk for things that are at risk, so that both parties, again, feel like they're getting a fair deal. So onward. Point number eight, how many unpopular actions will you have to do as the buyer? And you know, here are some. So if you buy the company and to right the ship, you've got to lay off a bunch of people, close some plants, figure out all new strategies because the old strategies aren't working anymore. You got to slash benefits or, micromanage a bunch of things. Wow, the risk just went way up. And even more because of social media, right? What do you think the Glassdoor chatter will be after you get through doing all those unpopular things? You know, word gets out around this. And when you do unpopular things, it shakes up the organization you just bought. After you do a layoff, a 25% layoff, can you imagine how many people are whining at the water cooler and afraid and what's going to happen next? And, you know, wow, just it's change, right? And typically when you have to take these unpopular actions, it happens quickly. And there's no time for that wonderful change management stuff and axis swinging. And so looking at a deal, it's not just the money that it'll take and that you'll save money or you'll have to invest a little money to make some changes. It's what's the effect on the momentum of that acquired organization. And momentum is such an important concept. Businesses have momentum. Acquire them, it shakes the momentum. But then if you have to swing the hatchet and make some big unpopular actions, that momentum just falls away fast. So don't underweight that as you think about the risk of a deal. So here we're on the home stretch here. You know, often when a company buys another firm, you think that the acquired company has to make all the changes. They're going to have to go to our IT system and move into our offices. But that's not always the case. Sometimes the buyer has to make some changes. We're going to go to their ERP system because it was better. And that is a big added risk element, especially if you're you know, $100 million business, you're buying a $10 million business. You've got a lot of people on your side and a lot of momentum that will take effort to change that as well. So if the buyer has to change, that's number nine. Number 10 has to do with a marketing impact. If we're buying another company and the brand's going to be the same, you know, no problem. But if the first thing we have to do is announce to 2,000 buyers that, you know, there's a new brand. The offices are changing. The bank branches are moving. All of a sudden, we've got risk. We've got to do a marketing campaign. Now we have to run a change management program around the customers and what they think and why they liked it. It's hard to tell. How many are staying just because of inertia? Hard to tell. So if there's going to be a marketplace shift, pay attention. 11 is, do we know how to run the business we acquired? I touched on this before. I totally knew how to run those publishing companies that I bought. But if I had bought, for example, a picture framing company, that's a whole other story. It's related, right? Many of our customers were picture framers, but now we're talking saws and molding and inventory and shipping in a very different way, right? And even the customer set for a framer is different than the customer set for us as a publisher. Lot more there. And very often in acquisitions, those people that came that you brought along, they just don't like you. They don't like the way it works. It's different. You lose a lot of them. And if you lose the key ones, you have to be ready to step in there and keep running that business. And if you don't know how to do it, risk is up, consequences high. And then my last point, right, number 12 here, is really, is there enough cash available to manage the complexity? It's not just that you paid $2 million for the business. You might have to do a capital infusion. It's going to cost you $50,000, $100,000, maybe more for legal fees. There's accounting fees, right? And then there's getting on planes and going to the acquired company. There may be moving expenses. So you have to have enough cash to do all of that stuff well to treat your new investment appropriately. And if not, if you've got to starve them for technology and those kinds of things, it just drives the risk up on the deal overall. So 12 critical risk areas. Really encourage you, go to that free assessment. It has a lot more explanation about what I mean by all those things. It's a really powerful tool.
Question came in. What tips for due diligence of revenue?
Well, I mean, one is get the data. You don't just take the revenue. And all the deals that we did, we actually requested and pulled down line item data from every order that they'd ever shipped, right? I mean, any company you buy of any size should have that kind of data. And we went through it and re-added it up and looked through what was the average size of orders and so on and so forth. You also have tax returns, of course, to validate that the revenue is really coming in. Are they really paying tax on it? So we're going to look at that from all perspectives to make sure it's real. And, you know, at times it's a little risky, but you can even talk to customers and do some validation with customers. Normally that's down further a little bit. But those are all some of the kinds of things you do to check and understand revenue.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. So, you know, just two more slides here. So getting deals across the line. So we've assessed it for risk. We want to do it. Some crucial questions. How well do you show it? An investment banker kind of posed that question. When you're meeting with potential sellers, they're seeing whether they like you. And some people are a little bit more uncouth. They're maybe overly bold. They're not good people. That's really important stuff, especially in privately held companies. And so there's an understanding of that. And if you're not very good at that stuff, you need an investment banker or someone else who can be your front person, right, and help coach you through that. You know, there's this huge key around that seller-to-buyer relationship. Too often, oh, how much do you want to buy for your company? Ah, that's the wrong first question. Sellers love their businesses, typically. And knowing that they like the person who's buying it, who's going to take good care of it, building trust, these are crucial, important things that you can't rush. So if you really want to buy that business and get a good deal, take your time, build a relationship. I think another important element is not every seller just wants maximum money. Maybe it is about their business or what's going to happen to their business. You have to take the time to listen and ask really deep probing questions so you understand what they really want and give them that in spades and give them less of all of the other things that they aren't as excited about. It's really critical to not assume.
That's a really good point, because we had a client where when we started working with them, they were probably around $15 to $18 million, and they grew their company to $60 million plus or so.
Nice.
And they had some attractive offers for substantially more than that, and they decided to take actually less money as long as the organization was going to keep the people intact. That was very important for them.
Very common, yes.
It didn't work, unfortunately, but the company after a year or two ended up throwing their own cultural issues into it. But the owners wanted to feel good about the whole thing. So that's a good point.
The blood wasn't on their hands, right? It wasn't on their hands, and they tried.
Right.
And look, you grow a business from 18 to 60, unless you're a big spender, you're making some good money along the way. And a lot of us, you know, we all want money, but at some point, people have enough, and they care about other things, and that's a great thing. So don't assume. You know, as the negotiations start, it's really helpful to find things to agree on first. And sometimes they're kind of obvious, but in a negotiation, getting that alignment, yep, I agree completely, you get that going, and you leave to the end the things that you're probably not going to agree on. It gets water under the bridge. It's a really important negotiating strategy. I think the other thing is, what will the businesses look like when they're together? And this may not be as important for a seller who's going to exit and retire and go away. But you're bringing in other people, other leaders. And if you want to keep them, isn't it important, probably before the deal closes, to say, hey, do you guys want to go into this market? We see it as awesome and fun and cutting edge. And you share that ahead of time so that when you close the deal, there's alignment about where we're going to go. In the research, a number of companies kept it kind of, you know, quiet where the business was going to go, and they did the deal. And then when the buyer's team, imagine engineers, technicians, technical people, found out that where they were going to have to shift now to was some boring technology that was uninspiring to them, they left, right? And all the value of the acquisition left because they didn't like where the buyer was taking it. Well, then why'd they even buy the darn company? So that's this notion around cementing that joint vision early so that everyone's aligned to get there. You know, last two points, own your deal. Investment bankers, lawyers, accountants, they always mean well. Most of the time they mean well, but it's your deal. And sometimes lawyers can be more diligent than you want. They can insist on things that could destroy your deal that might not make sense to you. And so as a buyer, you want to listen to those people. You want to understand all your advisors. In the end, it's your deal. It's your company. Make sure you get what you're looking for and don't get distracted. And then the last thing, of course, is that if you take too long, deals that just sort of stall often get killed. So when there's momentum to buy, do it right, do it diligently, but get it done. If you wait too long, it can just stall. So to wrap this up, just four quick summary points. Be strategic and not opportunistic. Don't buy a company because you can because it popped up. This should your tactics of acquisitions should tie to your strategies. Start small and lower risk. There's a lot to be learned in this very complex tactic called acquisitions. Third, walk away from dangerous deals. Hey, you do an average deal, that's one thing, but you do a real nasty one that blows up, it can erode all of the positive ROI from other acquisitions. And then last, be respectful. M&A is a complex maneuver. Just like I wouldn't go, I don't know, ski jumping just because I wanted to, thinking of the Olympics, right? No, you could get hurt, man. Don't do this at home. And that's true of M&A. It's complicated. Show respect. Learn what you need to learn. Surround yourself with the right kind of people so that you can execute it well. That's all I got.
Wow. Rob, this was just phenomenal. In just a minute, we're going to open up the line so you can talk to Rob directly if you have questions. But in case this topic can be, you might talk about things that are very confidential and you want to get some feedback, please feel free to call Rob. He'll spend some time with you. His contact information is on our program today. And again, we'll be sending out the slides and audio in the next couple of days. On March 29th will be our next open line program, and the topic is going to be on dealing with millennials. So I'm sure we'll have quite a few people attending that program. But I want to thank Rob so much for the valuable ideas that were shared today. Over the top, amazing, Rob. Thank you. So if everyone can please hold the line for a minute, and I'm going to ask you everybody to put your phone on mute, not on hold, but on mute. And then if you have a question for Rob, then unmute your phone, because we have quite a few people attending today. So hold the line for 1 second. We'll be right back.